This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Workplace immigration raids, drug pricing pushback, teaching ethics to the tech industry, and pizza. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, May 15th. Thanks for joining us. President Trump continued his calls today for crackdowns on illegal immigration. And on Monday, the administration said that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, better known as ICE, has more than doubled the number of workplace investigations compared to last year. Those are checks to make sure employers are hiring workers who are legally allowed to work in the U.S. The agency also said workplace audits and arrests are up as well. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
What happens in the interior of the country affects its borders, so says Matthew Allen with Homeland Security Investigations at ICE.
The vast majority of people that come to the United States come here primarily to get work. And if people can't get jobs in the United States that are not lawful to be here, then there's really no reason to come.
It's also about making sure companies employing undocumented labor don't get an unfair advantage. Thing is, unemployment in the U.S. is now very low.
There are labor shortages in some industries.
Ruth Milkman is a professor at the City University of New York.
And that includes industries which employ a lot of immigrants, including the undocumented or unauthorized immigrants. This is going to aggravate that. Employers were already concerned.
Among them, Chris Alonzo, a mushroom farmer in Pennsylvania. Every day, he says, he has to leave mushrooms unpicked. He'd hire 20 more workers if he could.
I'm asking people to stay later. I bought a van and I'm driving into Wilmington, Delaware every day to try to pick up people that are needing rides.
Alonzo says he's verified the documentation of his 100 employees, but only about half of all farm workers have work authorization, according to the Department of Labor.
If that group of people is not in the country anymore, then farms will fail.
He says he supports better border control, but he hopes the government will pair it with some kind of immigration reform that gives farmers like him more access to authorized workers. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
As Uber tries to rebuild public trust, it is changing how it deals with sexual harassment and assault claims. Employees, drivers, and riders will no longer be forced into arbitration, a process that critics say often favors corporations. And that means cases of alleged sexual assault by drivers or other issues can go to court. Uber's main rival Lyft also got rid of binding arbitration policies, and both companies said they will no longer require that settlements of sexual misconduct claims be kept confidential. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
This week, Uber launched a new ad campaign.
It's time to move in a new direction.
Part of that new direction is allowing alleged victims to take sexual misconduct claims to court. Uber's chief legal officer, Tony West, says the company will also publish data on sexual assaults.
We want survivors, we want women to be encouraged to report these incidents so that we can take action and begin to prevent sexual assault from occurring in the first place.
Microsoft has also dropped binding arbitration for sexual harassment claims. Ebony Tucker is a paid advisor to Uber with the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. She hopes others will follow.
There is something to be said for really large corporations setting the model for what their industry is going to look like.
The policy change could open Uber to expensive lawsuits, says Cornell labor relations professor Alexander Colvin.
On the other hand, they're probably suffering already from the bad publicity.
And as Uber aims for an IPO next year, it's under pressure to rebuild its reputation. Maya Raghu is director of workplace equality at the National Women's Law Center.
There's increasing public attention to this issue from all sorts of stakeholders, including consumers and shareholders.
Raghu points out Uber's new policy only applies to sexual misconduct. Claims of racial discrimination and other employment and consumer disputes will still be forced into arbitration. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Ramadan is beginning around the world this week. It is the holy month that Muslims observe by, among other things, fasting from sunrise to sunset. That month ends with a festival of prayer and feasting known as Eid. And despite the size of the Muslim population in the U.S., there's been relatively little retail activity around Ramadan. Earlier this year, though, Party City became the first major American retailer to offer a dedicated line of products for Ramadan. And as Rima Kreis reports, the chain may be wishing it hadn't waited so long.
Growing up Muslim in New Jersey, 32-year-old Neda Mirza says Ramadan and Eid always felt special. But still, something was missing.
I was just always so intrigued by the beautiful Christmas decorations my friends would have, the Hanukkah decorations.
Now, Mirza is a graphic designer with kids of her own, and she's been selling handmade Ramadan banners, napkins, and cards on Etsy for 3 years.
This year, it's like I can barely keep up, actually. It's so overwhelming in such a great way.
Party City could say the same thing. Last month, it introduced Ramadan and Eid banners, plates, gift bags, online and in a handful of stores. Most are already sold out. You might have expected Mirza to be worried about competition from a big retailer. She's not.
It's such an amazing feeling to feel represented.
U.S. retailers should realize that this is a growing consumer market. The American Muslim consumers in the U.S. are educated, savvy, they have spending power.
Sabiha Ansari heads up the American Muslim Consumer Consortium. She says there are nearly 3.5 million Muslims in the U.S.
I think there's a lot of potential there.
Retailers like Macy's and H&M are recognizing that, too, and have recently started marketing to Muslim women. Shalina John Muhammad is with Ogilvy Noor, a branding firm. She says for a long time, brands stayed away, fearing a backlash. But
they realize that they're going to get some kind of commentary on social media, whatever they do.
And that's just the nature of business. I'm Rima Kreis from Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, I hope you danced to the happy music yesterday, because you ain't going to hear it today. All the details when we do the numbers. This week, Facebook announced it has suspended 200 apps that may have misused user data. It's the result of an internal investigation after the Cambridge Analytica scandal sparked public outrage and raised ethical questions about how our personal information should be used and by whom. On the podcast called Make Me Smart, hosted by Kai Rizdahl and myself, we explored this topic with Professor Laura Noreen. She teaches a class on the ethics of data science at New York University. I started by asking her how this class came to be.
So New York University, where I teach, started a center for data science 5 or 6 years ago. And my job was kind of to watch that process unfold. And as I saw things that maybe could be addressed differently, raise my hand and say, hey, we should do this differently. And one of the things I raised my hand and said was, hey, I think we should probably teach ethics. You know, we're arming our students with some pretty powerful tools and really not a lot of contextual insight into how those tools are going to be used and deployed. And I think last week or a couple of weeks ago, there was a paper presented about predicting gang activity in Los Angeles. And the social scientists in the room said, hey, do you have any idea how this is going to be used or what kind of impact this is going to have on these communities? You're actually using out-of-date maps. Like, haven't these gangs kind of moved around and changed some? Like, this could go badly wrong. And the poor person presenting the paper said, oh, I'm just an engineer. I don't really know about that.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to present so that we don't put our students in a bad position where they think that they can behave as just an engineer.
So not to make it all about the class, but on day one of the class, how do you start? What's the opening? Welcome to class, students. And this semester we're going to be fill in the blank.
This semester we're going to be investigating how you can apply your data science methods effectively to both maximize benefits and minimize harms. It's a little bit of the Hippocratic Oath.
I was just going to say, it sounds very Hippocratic.
With a maximize benefits in there. Because I think, so if we look for a moment, if you don't mind me going off the rails a little bit, the European Union has really decided that one of the ways they're going to lead in data science is around ethics, and their general data protection regulation that's coming into effect later this month is a version of what I call a kind of delete and retreat model of data science ethics. And that does empower users. but I'm not sure that it will fully maximize benefits. I mean, there are many, many, many things we can do better if we do them with data science.
Yeah, that's like the really interesting argument right now as as companies and researchers are trying to develop fully fledged AI and machine learning algorithms that can cure diseases or predict pandemics, you know, that there is a lot of good. And so what is the alternative? What is the ethical way to feed those machines?
I think it's important, or it's been instructive for me to figure out, how did we get to this point where users are coming to companies and saying, hey, I'd like you to delete my data, just delete data. You know, I'm going to delete Facebook. The only strategies that we have as users are to just quit. They can't even understand the terms of service. And the EU's general data protection regulation does get at that a little. It sort of forces companies to write their terms of service in language that normal people can understand, which is helpful. That would be nice.
Yeah, it would be totally nice. But how realistic do you think it is? I mean, Zuckerberg, I think, said, you know, we're going to comply with the spirit, right, of GDPR. Well, how's that going to play out over here so that American consumers can enjoy the same levels of protection that consumers, you know, in Europe and probably eventually a bunch of the rest of the world are going to benefit from?
So Americans have very different understandings of what privacy means than Europeans do. They're a lot more willing to make the trade-off, like, well, I'll give you some of my data for free if you give me an awesome service that I don't have to pay for. So we may not want to import European ideas of privacy into the U.S. or into China or any other country. Like, people are tripping up on privacy a little bit, and I really think that what people are worried about when they worry about privacy is more about empowerment. They want to be able to know what's happening with their data and with the decisions that are being made, and then be able to intervene or interact in that space. And right now, they're not. And if we only allow them a chance to delete, they probably will do that more often because it's the only agency they've been given. But that might not really be what they want.
That's Professor Laura Noreen from New York University. To hear what she thinks about Facebook's future and the data ethics issue that no one is talking about, subscribe to the Make Me Smart podcast. Every year around this time, the U.S. Department of Education releases financial responsibility scores for private colleges, and a school's score is supposed to reflect its overall fiscal health. Schools that get failing scores from the government risk losing access to federal financial aid. And ideally, these scores protect students so they don't go to a school that's broke and that could close before they get their degree. Ideally. Carrie Young from WBUR reports.
About 5 small private colleges close their doors in the U.S. every year. That's according to Moody's Investor Service. One of the latest is Mount Ida College, a school with about 1,500 students in the Boston area.
My daughter is a freshman in the photography program, working for her BS.
Chris Connolly was one of dozens of parents who showed up at a recent Board of Higher Education meeting about the closure of the school and what it means for their kids. The University of Massachusetts Amherst is buying the college, and students in good standing will be allowed to transfer to one of the state college system's campuses. But not all of Mount Ida's majors are offered there.
We keep coming into roadblocks. There's nothing that matches what she signed up for.
Other state schools are now stepping up to take over some of Mount Ida's specialized programs, but many students are left without a clear path forward. So is there anything consumers can do to avoid getting stuck in a limbo like this?
I think that's a tricky question.
Dr. Talani Britton, who teaches higher education economics at Harvard, says yes and no. She explains it's a yes because all private colleges are issued financial responsibility composite scores by the U.S. Department of Education.
It's a single number as opposed to, a financial report that you then have to decode or decipher.
The composite scores look at factors like whether the school can cover its expenses and if it's operating within its means. Lower scores signify financial problems, which sounds helpful, but Britton says
this score actually doesn't have great predictive power.
Mount Ida, for example, consistently scored above the danger zone, even though it was millions in debt. Britton also notes that many schools that got low grades haven't closed. So what gives? Melissa Emery-Aris with the U.S. Government Accountability Office points out the formula is 20 years old.
The times have changed, and there are new metrics that are helpful to consider.
In response, the Department of Education is standing by its accounting practices, though it is convening a committee to review the formula. And Emery Aris says students shouldn't completely write off the scores.
Even though this is not the most accurate tool, it is still a useful indicator.
Mount Ida officials have not made themselves available for interviews since the announcement of the closure in early April. But at the time, college president Barry Brown said in an email that financial pressure on small colleges has never been greater, and our limited resources obligate us to consider the long-term future of our community. Mount Ida officials have also established a hotline to help students navigate their options. In Boston, I'm Carrie Young for Marketplace.
Coming up.
For the first time, I had like an extra crispy crust in my home oven.
The secret recipe behind a Neapolitan-style pizza may surprise you. But first, let's do the numbers. I told you it was a sad music. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 193 points, more than 0.75% to close at 24,706. The NASDAQ fell 59 points, 0.8%. It finished at 7,351. And the S&P 500 down 18 points, more than 0.2%, to end at 2,711. As mortgage rates start to climb, so do investor fears that the housing market may slow. So home builders got hammered. Get it? Home construction company D.R. Horton dropped 6 7/10%. Builder Taylor Morrison Home Corporation shed 5 1/4%. KB Home slid 4 1/10%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.07%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. And oh, wait, we are not done with the numbers after all. Here's a big one. 232%. That's how much the list price of the 100 most commonly used brand name drugs has climbed during the last decade, according to Express Scripts. Hence these numbers. State lawmakers this year have filed more than 150 bills to rein in drug costs, and 80% of people polled in a recent Kaiser Family Foundation survey said the cost of prescription drugs is too high. Last week, President Trump unveiled a long-awaited plan to cut drug prices. And here's a change. Some drug companies are starting to feel the squeeze from their own shareholders. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Kathy Rowan leads socially responsible investing for Trinity Health, which runs 86 hospitals in 21 states. Here is what she's worried about.
Drug price increases are contributing 100% of pharmaceutical companies' net income growth.
Rowan says some drug companies are only growing because they hike prices rather than developing new blockbuster drugs.
And we think those days are coming to an end.
The negative press and the public pressure on companies over prices raises a question. Are drug makers risking long-term sustainability for short-term profits? To answer that, a group of institutional investors, including Trinity and the United Auto Workers Retiree Trust, drafted a proposal for all shareholders of five companies to vote on at annual meetings this year. The proposal asked the boards of Bristol-Myers Squibb, Amgen, AbbVie, Eli Lilly, and Biogen to report annually on the link between executive compensation and the price of drugs. Attorney Beth Young drew up the proposal for the shareholder coalition.
The hope is that the board will think carefully about all of the pieces of the incentive compensation puzzle and the extent to which those pieces are serving the long-term interests of the company.
Investors are concerned that higher drug prices are driving away patients, hospitals, insurers, and federal and state governments. You know, their customers. One potentially troubling sign, rising executive bonuses, which are often tied to short-term incentives. According to Equilar, a firm that tracks executive compensation, bonuses at the five drug makers are bigger than the median at the 500 largest U.S. companies. Equilar's Dan Marsek says executive compensation is where you find a company's priorities.
Ultimately, that is where you can have some insight into the direction of the company, where that's going to go.
The goal of the coalition is fairly modest. Get company boards talking about whether executive pay is driving prices and threatening the company's future. Dr. Len Schleifer, CEO of the biotech firm Regeneron and a frequent critic of his own industry, says drug companies need to have these conversations.
Companies turn to price hikes frequently because they want to be growth companies. The least risky way to do this is obviously just raising your prices. And that became almost addictive to the industry.
None of the companies would comment for this story. All five drug companies have argued their boards routinely review whether executive pay encourages risky behavior, so extra shareholder scrutiny won't do much. Attorney Beth Young says over time, she's seen companies come around.
We're not here to tell companies that they shouldn't make money. We want them to be profitable because we own their stock.
Three of the five drug makers have already held votes at their annual meetings, and while all three have failed, each vote got at least 17% approval. Equilar's Dan Marsek says anything more than 10% is a strong first vote.
Even if it's not a majority vote, it's going to be enough for management and the board to take a closer look.
Investors plan to press other shareholders over the summer, hoping for a stronger showing next year. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On this program, between the tariffs and the manufacturing economy, we talk a lot about steel. It is less common for us to talk about steel and also pizza. But this next piece is about both of those things and the spirit of innovation. Here's Andres Legsden with more.
Well, I've been working in the family business for the last 15 to 20 years. My dad developed this product called a flip pad. And what that is, an attachment for backhoes. Our customer base would be including Caterpillar, John Deere, Volvo Construction. And so I remember in the summers in college, even on weekends as a teenager, working there. The smell of steel being cut and welded together and formed. And then I went off my own ways, studied culinary arts and restaurants, and never, to be honest, never really thought I'd be back in that business. And one night in 2011, February 12th, you know the day, I was reading the Wall Street Journal after work. I'm reading about the launch of this new cookbook being written by Nathan Myhrvold, who's a former Microsoft exec. Basically, it's a deep investigation into the math and the physics and the science of cooking. The third question was how to create a Neapolitan-style pizza at home. And my eyeballs really lit up. Nathan's answer was to literally Google your local steel shop and cut out some steel for a shelf. It was like somebody took a baseball bat and hit me over the head. It was a genuine, like, aha moment. So I ran out to my plant and I grabbed a piece of steel. You know, picture this pizza of steel that was rusted up. But in any case, I made some dough and for the first time, I had like an extra crispy crust in my home oven made on steel. My brother and father, you know, originally liked the idea, but like how difficult would it be for Stoughton Steel, who makes backhoe parts for Caterpillar, to come out with a kitchen product? So I shelved it, to be honest, for a full year. Just one day I woke up, you can cue the Rocky music, but I just kind of went for it. I started doing a lot of research and development. I'm going to give it a try because we've all had ideas. It's that execution on ideas that is so difficult because we're afraid or for whatever reasons. 6 months later, we launched and we literally sold 500 units in 30 days. So what I thought was going to be a side hustle, we had to now figure out, you know, my brother and I, how do we make these?
That was Andres Legsden, founder of the Baking Steel Company. He wrote a book called Baking with Steel. And we've got a couple of his pizza recipes at our website. That's marketplace.org. This final note before we go, the author Tom Wolfe died today at the age of 88. He's probably best known for The Bonfire of the Vanities and, of course, The Right Stuff. Lots will be written today about his impact on literature and fashion. He reportedly owned 40 bespoke white suits. But here's something appropriately quirky. We interviewed Tom Wolfe in 2004 as part of a holiday-themed series asking notable figures about the best gift they ever got. And his answer was kind of perfect.
The best gift that I ever received was a set of rubber dolls, which were the Seven Dwarfs. To me, they were alive. I'd seen the movie, and I could figure out what they would say in any given situation.
Godspeed, Tom Wolfe. Godspeed. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 193 points, more than 0.75%. NASDAQ down 59 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 fell 18 points, more than 0.2%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. But don't worry, he's back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.